I'm your host, Jenny Worthington, and I will be introducing you to people and organizations around the world who are working for animal welfare. We're being called to participate in making the world a better place, and the people I will be talking with are on the front lines of critical work that we need to know about so that we can support them. I hope you enjoy, and thanks for listening. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Hello Animal Talks. I'm Jenny Worthington, and I am here bringing you another wonderful guest, another person who is working for animal welfare. I bring you somebody every time who is part of an organization or working on their own for animal welfare. And it's my pleasure to introduce Patrick Ramage, who works for the International Fund for Animal Welfare and is their whale man. So he has been working diligently for the protection of whales around the world, working with the problems of pollution, ocean traffic, ocean noise, and working with countries around the world against whale hunting. He's been to the International Whale Conference with a delegation 12 times and maybe more. We'll find out. So I'm super pleased to have him here. I think whales are incredible, and I'd love to hear what he's doing. So welcome, Patrick.
Thank you, Jenny. It's good to be with you.
Yeah. Gosh, I'm so excited to hear about everything you're doing. It seems like you have your fingers in a lot of pies. Do you want to give a general overview of what you're doing? Or
sure.
You want me to just ask specific questions? Because I have some questions for sure that I'm ready to ask you.
I can give a quick general overview. I came to the International Fund for Animal Welfare from Washington, D.C. I was something of a political animal there earlier in my career and had a fair amount of international experience through childhood and early professional experiences. So when the opportunity arose to migrate to distant Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and to work for an international animal welfare organization, I was very intrigued and wanted to explore it further. And based on certain childhood experiences and subsequently with my wife, I felt a real pull toward whales and dolphins and the ocean environment. And so fairly early in my time working as director of public affairs then for IFAW, as we call it, I began concentrating and spending more and more time on some of the important ocean-related marine conservation and whale protection work that IFAW is engaged in, both here in the United States and through our 16 offices around the world. I've been, as you referenced, to a number of international meetings, some 15 now. I think of the International Whaling Commission, the intergovernmental body that has a lot to do with whale protection, conservation, and international policymaking on whales, and a whole wide variety of experiences and interchanges and international efforts aimed at protection of our planet's largest species and their ocean habitat. And these animals, as you alluded to, face more threats today than any time in history. Not so much killing of whales by humans for their parts and commercial trade in their meat and other products, but human activities of a different sort are affecting the welfare and, in fact, the survival of marine animals, whales in particular, in a whole variety of ways that we can get into. So over the course of 2+ decades now for IFAW, I've focused very intently on whale protection and been, as you say, kind of regarded as the whale man. We have a number of highly qualified scientists who are my colleagues that are very intently focused on marine mammals as well. I've tended to be more of a external representative, spokesperson, campaigner, and policy advocate for those species. It's been a fascinating time, and the issues get ever more urgent. The people that I get to work with, both at the International Fund for Animal Welfare, government decision makers, and other advocates, are just such a committed and sharp group of folks. I never thought I'd be with IFAW or any employer for more than 2 decades, but it's the privilege of my professional life, and I can't give it up.
Well, it sounds like you're doing really important things because somebody's got to do it. it's, you know, we're sort of at a critical mass period, I think, where all these animal issues have to be addressed in order for humans to keep going as well.
Yeah, our ancestors in an earlier time, a lot of their challenge, you know, very early in the human experience, and then, you know, really up through several hundred years ago, was kind of to protect ourselves from the wild beasts. And certainly in contemporary society and at a global level, it's protecting those wild species that remain from us. And it's human activities at a macro level with issues now such as climate change and other global issues that are affecting these species and our own that are the challenges that we confront. And then locally and decisions of individuals, communities, regions, governments at a national level and international level pose an interesting sort of obstacle course toward getting things back on course for animals and people both to thrive. And as an organization, IFAW is intent on identifying and forging solutions to some of these challenges. We advocate, but it's not just advocacy or protest or public awareness. We're seeking to partner with a range of stakeholders to make a difference in the water, in this case, for whales, dolphins, and other marine mammals, with some success and a lot of continuing challenges.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing to think that the biggest animals on the earth are being threatened by us. And I'm curious to know, like, what do you think the biggest human threat is? Do you think it's the whale hunting or the nets or boat accidents, the noise pollution? Can you pick one out, or they're just all contributing equally to whale problems?
Well, the cumulative threat of the various challenges and the human activities that you list there, Jenny, the cumulative threat is massive. Among those, thankfully, commercial whaling, in which the U.S. led the world, but many other countries, north and south, east and west, were also very actively engaged for more than a century, massively reduced the number of whales of various species as commercial whalers progressed their way through very large whales, the blue whale being not only the largest whale, but the largest creature ever, including dinosaurs, ever on Earth is the blue whale. Some 5,000 to 10,000 of those animals remain, but a massive reduction from their historic pre-whaling levels. And then progressively, as is so often the case when animal numbers are harnessed to a commercial activity, commercial whalers moved sort of down the list to now the smallest of our planet's great whales, the minke whale, named for Dr. Minke, who discovered it, is the principal target of Japanese and Norwegian whaling, which persists today, but at much smaller levels. The year that I was born, 57 years ago, 1963, about 50,000 whales were taken worldwide by commercial hunting. And this year, it will be fewer than 1,200. And that is great news. And the three countries that have persisted in commercial whaling, even following an international moratorium or ban on the practice imposed in 1986. And the three countries that continued were Japan, Iceland, and Norway. And Japan, over the last several years, has dramatically reduced and its whaling. It stopped its whaling on the high seas. It's retreated from the waters of Antarctica, but is still killing whales in its coastal waters, and a practice that makes no more sense than its high seas whaling. But there's a dwindling market for whale meat, and it seems like we're seeing the beginning of the end of Japanese whaling entirely after some sharp reductions and cessation of their high seas whaling, which is very good news. Iceland has not gone whaling for the last 3 years. The Icelandic government and the private sector have found that tourism, ecotourism, which is a real benefit to Iceland, and including whale watching, whale and dolphin watching in Iceland, is generating vast economic benefits that vastly outstrip any profit to be made from whaling. And, and Icelanders, like the Japanese, have lost their taste for their taste for whale meat. And Norway is now the world's leading whaling nation, issuing quotas of 1,200, 1,400 whales each year, minke whales, the smallest of the great whale species that I mentioned earlier. And that's something that, based on some successful efforts by IFAW and our own experience in both Japan and Iceland at discouraging whaling, encouraging whale watching instead, we're hopeful that based on our learnings in those settings, that we can contribute to Norway finding its way out of the whaling business as well. That's a long diversion into commercial whaling. The point being, though, that while it was the greatest historic threat to whale populations, it thankfully has significantly declined. The leading threat, to answer your question, Jenny, the leading threat today that in terms of human activities impacting whales and other marine mammals is entanglement in fishing gear. It's speculated that between 400,000 and 600,000 marine mammals per year are being killed through entanglement in fishing gear. Right. Now, that includes seals, dolphins, a range, manatees, a whole range of species, including whales.
That's a huge number.
Sea turtles are also sadly killed in great numbers in entanglement in fishing gear, either through nets, fishing nets and gear that is used in active fishing operations, or increasingly we're learning with some species, including a critically endangered whale that swims up and down the eastern seaboard of the U.S., the North Atlantic right whale, 360 of which remain today. Are the main entanglement threat is the vertical buoy ropes for lobster and crab gear. Mm-hmm. So the vertical buoy ropes marking the gear that extend from traps on the bottom of the sea up to the surface. The right whales, unfortunately, the leading cause of death for right whales is entanglement in those vertical buoy ropes as these school bus sized animals navigate up their ancient migratory pathways, they become entangled. After that, ship strikes, ocean noise, industrial pollution, plastics, which we're all more aware of now than several years ago, add on to the list of threats posed by human activities to these creatures. It's an ocean of troubles to deal with, but in each case, some solutions are surfacing, and we're hopeful that we can highlight and promote those along with other organizations and governments to make a difference.
Right. Well, with the whale hunting, I still don't understand really what they're getting out of it. It's mostly the meat that they're going, that they're hunting the whales for?
Chiefly, yes. Whale oil in an earlier time lit the lamps of the Western world.
Yeah.
And whaling was much more central to the U.S. economy and culture than it has ever been in Japan, Iceland, or Norway. With the discovery of petroleum resources, I guess, initially in Pennsylvania and now the world over, that continue to power not just lamps, but all manner of activities that we all are engaged in every day, the pressure for whale oil was significantly reduced. Yeah. That vestigial whaling that is still going on, the principal declared target is meat for the market. In each of the cases, though, Japan, Iceland, and Norway, their governments continue to support it. They make cultural arguments in support of it. They lobby aggressively for it. But it is no longer a situation where there is significant public demand in each of the three whaling countries. It's sort of a cultural relic. And each of the governments, Iceland, as I noted in recent years, thankfully, has seemingly ended its whaling activities. But in each case, despite, you know, government promotion and inducement of the various fisheries agencies, the sensibilities and taste buds of the public in those countries have thankfully moved on.
So is it largely politically driven then? Like, do the populations of those countries, the actual people, support the whaling, or it's just more of an old political thing that they hang on to?
It's much more the latter. So I've had the opportunity, it's been a real privilege over the course of my time with IFAW to spend a lot of time in Japan and drawing on some earlier experiences in my environmental work with political leaders in the U.S. and Japan. I've had a lot of opportunity to interact with Japanese decision makers, elected officials, and government officials in Japan. And my own direct experience and public survey work that IFAW has conducted, other groups, Greenpeace, some years ago, worked with Japanese agencies to do a lot of public opinion survey work. And I know from my own intense interactions with Japanese politicians and from the numbers in nationwide surveys that it would be misleading to say that the majority of the Japanese people support whaling. Most, and partly this is a cultural phenomenon, but most respondents in a nationwide survey in Japan would identify themselves as indifferent or not having an opinion on whaling. And so Japanese friends have taught me that no. The Japanese in the main are not pro-whaling, but they are anti-whaling. Which is to say, if groups from outside Japan are protesting Japanese whaling and governments are giving the Japanese government a hard time about whaling, that does not go over well in Japan, including in the corridors of power in Tokyo.
Right.
That is not a uniquely Japanese phenomenon. We in this country don't appreciate other countries explaining to us why our practices are unacceptable. But as an advocacy organization, and there are many fine and committed organizations working hard on these issues and certainly have been over the years on the whaling issue, the challenge is to approach the issue and the decision makers in ways that don't result in them just circling the wagons and doubling down on their policy. And that challenge, I think it's safe to say that some external protests and activities by both advocacy organizations and governments have almost extended the period of time and kept some limited whaling on life support in a way, because conservative pro-whaling politicians have used that external pressure to rally internal support for an outmoded industry that really has no place in the 21st century. So it is mostly a political phenomenon in Norway and Japan, in very particular coastal communities that have significant political influence. There is a pro-whaling lobby. Some of that is generational. Younger folks in Japan, Iceland, and Norway really aren't that interested in whale meat. But an industry in its final death throes, apologists for whaling in all three countries have been increasingly desperate and sometimes used nationalism and national pride as an excuse for perpetuating an unacceptable activity.
Yeah, yeah. So you have to be a real diplomat when you're approaching this issue.
A mix of carrot and stick is important, but ultimately the decision to end whaling in Japan, Iceland, and Norway is not going to be made in Washington, D.C. or London or Canberra or Wellington, New Zealand. And it's not going to be made on the floor of the International Whaling Commission, where a moratorium was imposed. The Whaling Commission already decided that in 1986. It's going to be made. The decision to end whaling will be made in the capitals of the whaling countries, in Tokyo, Reykjavik, and Oslo, by Japanese, Icelandic, and Norwegian politicians who will make that decision for reasons that make sense to them.
Right.
And accelerating that, I think, inevitable decision is what we have focused our limited resources and efforts on with some success. That's a more subtle and in some ways, in terms of a media story or whatever, it's a less compelling contribution, but vital, almost assisting these countries in migrating out of this outmoded practice.
Yeah. Do places like Japan and Norway have any kind of whale watching tourism going on?
Yeah, all three whaling countries, there's world-class spectacular whale watching.
Really?
And that has been very helpful. Whale watching now takes place in 120 countries and territories worldwide.
Wow.
It is a truly global ecotourism success story. If you count ticket sales and the sort of secondary tourism revenues associated with whale watching operations, it's a $2 billion contribution to coastal economies in these many countries. And we know this because IFAW first in 2001 and then again in 2010 did a painstaking, we worked with environmental economists, a group called Economists at Large from Sydney, Australia, and did a painstaking survey over a two-year period in each case of whale watching operations in each of this growing number of countries conducting this practice. And ironically, some of the best whale watching in the world occurs off the coast of Japan, where it's an island nation, obviously, and where the depth of the ocean's just offshore of these volcanic islands, and the diversity and strength of the ocean currents in that part of the world affords tourists very close into shore to see many species of whales and dolphins. These are small-scale operators, but more than 100 of them now strewn from the northern island of Hokkaido in the far north to Ogasawara and Okinawa in the far south. And partnering with those committed Japanese operators has enabled a situation where, let me put it this way, Jenny, at least in our approach at the International Fund for Animal Welfare, where we are searching for solutions that work for animals and people that allow both to thrive. So our particular focus and obsession is identifying solutions that work for both animals and people, where wild species can be conserved and communities can prosper. In the course of that work, one of our learnings is that being for something, advocating for something, can often be more effective than protesting against. And our work with Japanese whale watch operators, as with Icelandic and Norwegian whale watch operators and ecotourism businesses, and that whole sector, that's a situation where you are being pro-coastal economy and community. You are being pro-economic contributions nationally and regionally. And it's not just pointing the finger and bashing the individual whaler or the government that represents him. That pressure needs to continue. And we've helped facilitate and amplify on that pressure in different settings. But part of helping government decision makers find their way to the end of whaling is for them to see the economic benefits that flow to these same communities who are now prospering much more than they would be had they continued to go whaling, given the dwindling number of citizens that are interested in whale meat. So it's very encouraging to see this 21st century sector, ecotourism generally, at least, you know, hopefully responsible ecotourism, and whale watching in particular, continue to expand.
Yeah. It seems like it would be kind of dicey, though, going out to do some coastal whale watching and maybe run into some coastal whale hunting. Does that ever happen?
That has happened. It's on a limited basis. Much of Japan's whaling was conducted on the high seas, far away from its own shores, even as far as Antarctica and Antarctic waters. But your question brings to mind, there were incidents just off Reykjavik in a large body of water there called Faxaflói Bay. Reykjavik-based whale watching operators and their customers, the tourists often, there were several instances where off in the distance, whaling operations were being conducted while excited tourists were eager to see humpback whales, minke whales, and fin whales, other species, and shoot them with cameras instead of harpoons. And obviously, the whale watch operators, eager to provide a positive experience for their ticket-buying customers, were very concerned about this. And there's a network of whale watching operators in Iceland called Ice Whale. And they banded together and began working to expand the protected area for whales off of Reykjavik, where a lot of Icelandic minke whale hunting, again, the smallest of the great whale species, was taking place. As a result, after a period of years and some some false starts. There was a significant expansion of the Fox Floyd Bay whale watching area. This forced minke whalers to travel a lot further out to an area well removed from the eyes of tourists and whale watch operators to conduct their whaling activities. That greatly increased fuel costs and ultimately an industry that was already struggling and often in the red. 2 years ago, the Icelandic minke whalers said, we're quitting, and we're quitting permanently. And part of the reason is it's just costing us too much in terms of fuel expenses. So a positive effort to advance a safety area for whales ultimately was able to see the death of the whaling industry in coastal waters in Iceland. A very welcome development, and I've always proud to partner to make that possible.
Wow, that's incredible. Really incredible. Wow. Are the right whales that swim up and down the east coast of the U.S., are they the most endangered whales that we have that are in the oceans?
Yes. So the North Atlantic right whale, of which some 360 remain, has critically endangered status both in the U.S. under our Endangered Species Act and now the IUCN, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. Right whales, sadly, have received the highest listing on what's called the IUCN Red List of endangered species. It's the most endangered large whale species on the planet. And whaling certainly contributed to this crisis. Yankee whalers, historically, in the waters near where I live on Cape Cod in Massachusetts, Yankee whalers targeted the right whale. In fact, the very name of the species exists because whalers deemed it the right whale to hunt.
Oh.
It's large, carries a lot of oil. It's a slow swimming species of whale. Spends a lot of time at the surface, so easier to target, even for primitive whaling operations. And critically, it floats when it's dead. Right whales float when they're dead.
Oh.
So this coastal animal spending a lot of time in shallower inshore waters was a ready target for early whaling operations. And there's speculation that there may have been as many as 50,000 or so right whales when Yankee whaling got underway. Early journals from early settlers to our region talk about how there were so many right whales in Cape Cod Bay that it seemed that one could walk across the bay on the backs of these animals who were so frequently surfacing. Wow. And it's a powerful reminder each spring, the remaining population, a significant part of them, up to 3/4 of the remaining right whales on the planet, congregate in Cape Cod Bay, about a mile from where I live, this significant bay off Massachusetts, as they migrate up from calving grounds where mother right whales are having their calves off of Florida and Georgia. And they follow their ancient migratory pathways up the eastern seaboard of the U.S. and spend most of the summer up in Canadian waters off of Newfoundland, Nova Scotia, in the Bay of Fundy in the Gulf of St. Lawrence.
Wow.
They've done that for millennia. And that migration now is significantly threatened, first and foremost by more than a million vertical buoy ropes that are being used by lobster and crab fishermen, and also by ship traffic and even recreational vessel traffic in and out of ports and marinas throughout their range. Particularly, and sadly, two calves over the last 12 months, two young calves were struck and killed near their calving grounds in the southeast by vessels, whether commercial or indications are in one of the instances, it was a smaller vessel that was involved. So the United States and fishermen and mariners operating in U.S. waters have taken a variety of steps and been required under federal and state regulation to take a variety of steps to try and mitigate the threats of entanglement and ship strikes of right whales, and which are the two leading causes of death. These animals are not dying of old age. They're dying because we are killing them. Right. And human activities are killing them, and human activity and ingenuity is what is going to save them. In the case of the vertical buoy ropes attached to lobster and crab gear, IFAW is working with technology companies and early adopter lobstermen on ropeless fishing gear, harnessing 21st century technology to allow a situation where the lobsterman sets their traps on the seafloor, and as they usually do, but is able to recall those traps with acoustic technology so that like a Bluetooth signal is sent and releases a temporary retrieval buoy up to the surface, sort of on-demand recall of the gear, rather than having a constant, persistent vertical buoy rope in the water. Technology is also coming to the rescue on the ship strike threat. IFAW has worked with federal scientists and some very creative app developers to create an app. You know how we say today, there's an app for that, for just about everything, called Whale Alert. And it is a tool that displays for mariners the location of where whales have been heard, where whales have been sighted as they are navigating up and down the east coast of the United States. And it shows protected areas and go slow zones, enabling the mariner on the bridge of the ship to be aware, to slow down, to comply with some of these speed restrictions, or otherwise take action to avoid ship strikes with whales. Essentially putting a conservation solution right in the hand of the mariner. The app is called Whale Alert. It's free on the App Store on Apple type phones and in Google Play and for Android. And we're shortly to release a 3.0 version of Whale Alert, which has been around for almost a decade now. But the 3.0 version that we're about to release will improve functionality. And one of the things that the app enables is interested friends of whales, citizen scientists on shore or out on a vessel, when they see a whale either swimming or stranded, they can report its location, they can send a photo. And in the case of stranded or entangled whales, they can use the app to instantly notify stranding response or entanglement responders. So more information is at whalealert.org and also at ifaw.org, obviously. And the Whale Alert app is a free download and tons of information. There's an identity guide for here's what the different species of whales look like in the water. Here's what they would look like if they were stranded. It's an idiot-proof app. I know this because I am the idiot that they used to
test it on you.
To try it out. Yeah, not super tech savvy. But that and increasingly sophisticated monitoring of acoustic monitoring, photographic monitoring. In the case of the right whale, even researchers using drones and observers from flights from the National Marine Fisheries Service are tracking these animals along their migration, and significant efforts are being made in U.S. and Canadian waters now to protect them. Right. One final aspect with right whales, because I think it shows how all of us are contributing to this crisis and all of us have a role to play in resolving it. When I first came to IFAW, there were even fewer right whales. I think there were some 250 of the animals that remained. The principal cause of their mortality were ship strikes in U.S. waters. In 2008, a ship speed rule was put in place in critical habitat areas in U.S. waters. And it required commercial vessels of 65 feet or more to slow down to 10 knots when whales were present, when these what are called seasonal management areas, when these speed restrictions were imposed. And those areas are shown on Whale Alert and constantly updated. And that conservation measure, slowing down fast-moving shipping traffic, in critical habitat areas for migrating right whales had a massive conservation benefit. Wow. And by 2015 or so, the population had almost doubled in size. We got up as high as, well, more than 500 animals. Since that time, and over the last 5 years in particular, the right whale numbers have continued, have returned to a downslope.
Yeah.
And now we're at 360 individual animals, only 80 of which are breeding age female whales.
Wow.
Critical in terms of having a population rebound. So it's quite a dire situation.
Do we know why that went down? Do you know why?
Yes. Again, broadly speaking, the problem is us. And we have to help change the situation in the water for these animals. What has happened, Jenny, is that significant annual migration up and down the eastern seaboard that mothers and calves are making between the calving grounds off Florida and Georgia and the feeding grounds up off Nova Scotia is getting longer and longer.
Well,
because the rate of temperature change, increasing temperature, warming of the waters of the North Atlantic is moving more quickly at an accelerated pace compared to other waters of the global ocean worldwide. The fastest temperature increase is going on in the North Atlantic. And so these animals chasing their prey, a copepod, sort of a microscopic shrimp type species that these animals consume, they're coming up the eastern seaboard. They're gathering here in Cape Cod Bay because at particular water temperatures, cooler water temperatures, their prey species, these tiny little microscopic animals, are concentrated. As the water has been warming, the right whales have to go further and further in their annual migration to get to the cooler waters where their food source is abundant. So perversely, climate change and ocean warming, driven fundamentally by our emissions of carbon and human activities that generate greenhouse gases, are forcing right whales to swim further and further. That's exposing them more in Canadian waters to entanglement and ship strikes, where Canada's catching up now, but for several decades was not imposing the measures that we needed to impose in U.S. waters.
Right.
And also, even if they avoid entanglement or ship strikes, whales are exhausted. So new mothers and potential mothers among the right whale population, if you're spending all your energy and fat resources, and if it's taking everything out of you to make that migration, then the number of calves, we've seen a steady decline against what we would normally expect from a similar number of female whales in the population. They're having fewer and fewer calves as a result of the sort of non-lethal impacts of entanglement, ship strike, longer migration to get their foodstuffs. So it's a tricky issue.
Sorry. So they're actually not birthing the calves. It's not that they're losing them on the way up because, like, they're starving. They're actually deciding that not to reproduce.
Right. The marine biologists and experts that work with the Marine Mammal Rescue and Research Team at IFAW,
mm-hmm.
And others we partner with, federal scientists, Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, explain that if the stresses already on the individual whales are such that there are challenges to their ability to survive, to feed themselves, to communicate, etc., those non-lethal impacts, so they're not being struck
right.
by a ship, they're not being drowned through an entanglement, but are their fitness and ability to reproduce and successfully carry their young to term. The pregnancy cycle of a female right whale is about the same as our species. So their ability to successfully reproduce in numbers that will allow the species to rebound is severely compromised. Also, very recent research by an advisor we have to our marine mammal rescue unit, Dr. Michael Moore, renowned right whale veterinarian and researcher. He and colleagues have just come out over the last 6 weeks with a paper showing that those right whales that are being born and right whale adult whales presently are smaller than their ancestors. So again, this all relates to foodstuff and energetics and some of the very real threats. More than 80% of the existing right whales in the world show signs, scars of entanglement in fishing gear.
Wow.
Again, the vertical buoy ropes from lobster and crab gear. So it is a very challenging situation, but vital to engage with stakeholders, including fishermen and mariners, and government officials who are overseeing and regulating their activities to forge policy solutions that work. And there's a high degree of skepticism. If you can imagine, we're partnering with a number of early adopter fishermen on the East Coast. And in some of the early discussions years ago, when the technology companies and scientists and policy folks like me were explaining to some of these fishermen that, what you do is you take your expensive gear that you've invested in and you throw it over the side with no buoys to mark it, but it'll work. Don't worry, it'll work. You know, there's a high degree of skepticism, and understandably so. But some of the most compelling and convinced conservation advocates and whale huggers I have met are commercial fishermen. Why? They are making their living from the water. They are out there all the time. They have a real appreciation of the ocean environment. They're in love with the sea. There are certainly conflicts and interests that are intersecting here, where it's the survival of two iconic species in New England that we are focused on: North Atlantic right whales in the first instance as an animal welfare organization, but also New England lobstermen.
Right.
And it's not easy, but in order to progress solutions that have some hope of saving both of these critically endangered species, you have to enlist the fishermen who are making their living from the sea, and their ingenuity and practical sense of, you know, what is possible and isn't possible to facilitate a situation where hardworking fishermen who spend their time, you know, on the surface of small vessels being tossed about in rough North Atlantic waters, sitting down with technologists and, you know, innovators from technology companies, the positive solutions that are coming out of that, the gear that now, the ropeless gear, some 3 or 4 years on since we conducted some of the very first familiarization testing here on Cape Cod with local lobstermen. The gear is improving by leaps and bounds, and the removal of those deadly vertical buoy ropes is increasingly the focus of policymakers in New England states, up and down the East Coast, and at the federal government level. It's a race against time on both the entanglement and the shipping side. Right. That's before we even get to threats like ocean noise, plastics, and other issues. It's not as well known as the plastic straw, but polypropylene lines in fishing gear are the principal source of plastic in the ocean. It's massive. And gear that is lost, so-called ghost gear, are like a floating trap for right whales, certainly, and other marine species, both endangered and abundant. So we need to do more than limit our use of plastic straws. All of us engaging and supporting and encouraging our government officials to insist on some of these positive solutions will hopefully allow right whales to continue to thrive and fishermen to have access to important fishing areas at the same time.
Wow, what a big ask. That's a big job, but super exciting that the fishermen or the lobstermen are willing to work on it. I mean, you know, if you get the beginners going and finding success, I think it'll catch on with other people. I'm imagine there's some benefits to them as well, not having the older equipment.
Well, and it's not dissimilar to what we were earlier talking about in terms of national sensibilities of countries that were being given a hard time by IFA and others about whaling activities.
Yeah.
Many, I dare say the majority still of hardworking lobstermen would rather fight than switch to this new ropeless gear. Right. There are a lot of myths about it. There are concerns about it. But it's those fisherman to fisherman communications by folks that actually prefer it and are using it. That's beginning to make this shift. And the benefits, as you mentioned, Jenny, the government is obliged under our laws and regulations to close areas to fishing. And those closure areas are expanding. And if fishermen want to retain access to important fishing areas for much of the year, then they need to be shifting to gear that doesn't pose a deadly threat to migrating whales who are coming through those areas during those times. Mm-hmm. So as more early adopter fishermen demonstrate that, we're able to fish here, but you have to stay home because you're still using those outmoded, that antique vertical buoy rope that, you know, their great granddaddy first used the gear in 1860, in the 1860s when it was invented. There have been very few changes to lobster fishing technology since. You know, these are hardworking folks who, there was a politician in the 1950s in this country named Adlai Stevenson.
Oh, yeah. And
he used to say, humans are unique animals. We only read the writing on the wall when our back is to it. And growing numbers of fishermen who rely on their ingenuity and hard work and wits out on the water to make their living are, of course, looking into the future and saying, hey, wait a minute, we should be acquainting ourselves with and helping improve this ropeless gear, which will give us access to important fishing areas and therefore more economic benefit. So again, just as in the case of Japan with respect to whaling and the economic benefits of ecotourism in Iceland, finding the argument or benefit that resonates with the target audience, who might not be, you know, animal and whale huggers like you and me, and enlisting them in accelerating the solution is one of the most satisfying aspects of the work that I get to do.
I can imagine it would be amazing. Yeah, yeah. But I think it takes, you know, a really good open mind to not steamroll these people that you think are doing something that you wouldn't want done. I think that's so much easier to try to do. So I think it's incredible that the time is being taken to really work with the different people, address their needs, combine them with the needs of the animals, and work for a solution that's going to, you know, benefit everybody.
And Jenny, you know this, because in the course of your wonderful work with these talks and your own passion for these issues and your migration in your own professional life to be, you know, focused full time now on animal welfare, our sector, our movement, our spectrum of animal lovers is not just a monolith of individuals or individual organizations that see and approach things in lockstep all the same way. Uh-huh. Our movement is a mosaic of different groups, each with their piece to play, their particular color or shade or interpretation and capacity and particular contribution. And that's a good thing because it takes a spectrum of activity, perspective, and advocacy in order to get things done. Policymakers and, you know, sometimes advocacy groups that consider themselves very mainstream might scoff often or question more radical organizations that take a harder line on something. And I don't mean, you know, eco-terrorist organizations or whatever, but organizations that are more aggressive in terms of the policy change that they want to see and more adamant about that. And I remind colleagues sometimes, hey, we need those people sort of pushing hard and out at the vanguard, and successful campaigners need a variety of tools in the toolkit. It's not just sitting and haggling over written policy, and it's not just relying constantly on, oh, if we can develop the technology, then it'll just magically happen and be solved. Uh-huh. And it's certainly not just standing with your sign outside the Japanese embassy saying ban whaling now, uh-huh. but it's some of all those things. It's some of carrot and stick. So the spectrum of advocacy organizations is important, that full range. And IFOS's particular contribution is our story to ourselves is we are about fresh thinking and bold action and partnering for progress. Mm-hmm. And we are so proud to join with other men and women of conscience and concerned organizations from across the spectrum of this community to try and forge that positive progress. And we have to accelerate it because scientists tell us with the example of the right whale, scientists tell us that, you know, if we don't accelerate these changes within the next 5 years, within the next 2 decades, this animal could be functionally extinct, which is to say there'd be a few individuals remaining, but not sufficient to ultimately rebound.
Right. That's incredible to even think about.
Our parents' generation functionally ended whaling, passed an international moratorium on the practice, reduced the numbers down from 50,000 50 years ago to, you know, the last gasp of whaling today. And these animals face more threats today than ever before in history. And our generation's obligation is to look at our activities that are impacting whales and their ocean habitat and take whatever steps we can to secure these species for the future so that our kids and grandkids, you know, can still go out and see these incredible animals alive in their natural environment.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate everything you're doing. I really do. I've kept you for a long time, but I do want to just look over my questions here real quick.
Sure.
Let me just ask you one last thing and then I'll let you go. But like for people that are totally not interested in whales, what is the importance of them? Like what would happen to the oceans if the whales weren't there?
You know, whales are unique, a unique species in nature. They have unique status under international law and regulation. Most species are highly migratory. So they don't stay in one particular area. They don't recognize, you know, national boundaries. And, you know, these animals are the stuff of myth and story, and their presence on this planet precedes our own. In the whale is the first creature mentioned in Hebrew scripture, Genesis 1:21, and God created the great whales. And whatever your creed or level of concern about whales, they have been significant in sort of human consciousness and story, and they play a significant role on the ocean planet. They are fundamental to healthy oceans. Thriving whale populations play an integral part in a healthy ocean. Healthy whales means healthy fisheries, means healthy ocean ecosystem. There is cutting edge research now showing that whales provide carbon sinks, and the scientists say, in contribute to the ocean's ability to absorb some of the carbon. The oceans, the so-called lungs of the planet, are a critical element in the effort to reduce greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And whales, in terms of their diving down to ocean depths, bringing ocean species and different trophic levels of ocean elements up to the surface have been called a so-called, you know, carbon pump, the underwater carbon pump. And whales themselves are regarded as carbon sinks when they die and go into the deep ocean environment. We talked earlier about whale watching. Whales' contribution to ecotourism in coastal communities around 120 countries and territories today is very real, returning profits that are much greater than the whaling industry in earlier times. And finally, and perhaps most fundamentally, whatever we as individuals might think about them, whales are an icon of the environmental movement and the animal movement. And what's increasingly clear is that we need to change our activity in order to allow these species to survive. And some of the same issues, including global climate change, that are beginning to have such a dramatic and visible impact. I think now, you know, the flooding in Europe that we're observing, and some of these other every 100-year, every 1,000-year weather events that are regularly occurring, you know, that human-caused phenomenon is having a dramatic impact on the ability of right whales to survive. Right. If we cannot come together across different sectors to take appropriate adjustments and make corrections to human activities that are threatening this species so that this animal, ancient animal, can continue into the next century, how in the world will we ever summon the ability to make some of these larger changes? So even if someone can't stand whales, I think that they are not just symbolic, they are a manifestation of the global environmental crisis and a test case as to, all right, are we able to conduct our activities that allow us to prosper without killing off this species? And so I think in a way, our ability to change our ways and improve the trajectory and prospects for conservation and protection of these species is a preview of the more and more serious challenges that we will confront for the health, welfare, and long-term survival of our own species in the way that we want on this planet. So I think that just as they've been tied together in myth and story with us since ancient history, our fates and futures are also intertwined over the longer term. So economic contribution to coastal communities, positive impact on some of the environmental challenges, including climate change that the ocean faces today, some of this cutting edge science is demonstrating. And then as a both emblem and test case of whether we are able to summon ourselves and redirect our activities to protect these species and the ocean environment, and see that as part of the process of putting the world on course for to be a place where all life can thrive. All of that comes into play when we're undertaking Leviathan efforts to save our planet's great whales and the ocean environment on which our prosperity, like theirs, very much depends.
Yeah, yeah.
That is a long and meandering answer.
It was very, very profound and made a lot of sense.
Okay, well, you're very nice to say that. Yeah, part of the joy and challenge of working for IFAW is with our 17 offices around the world, somewhere is always open.
Right.
So my European colleagues have already been at it for 5 or 6 hours by the time I'm signing on in the morning. And, you know, fairly often my workday ends very late in the evening when I'm on the phone with our Australia office or colleagues in Japan. It can be long days, but lucky us to be able to do work that has, you know, such a positive and important impact, and to be joining colleagues both in our organization and more broadly that are committed to a better future for animals and people.
Yeah, all over the world. I mean, that's super cool.
No, it really, I pinch myself still every day. It really is. And it would not happen except for the commitment of folks like you, Jenny, and the people that are tuning in, because they're the ones who are supporting the work, encouraging change by government officials, taking actions, you know, reducing their own use of plastic. So I have friends that are corporate lawyers, that are advertising executives, and they don't care less about the planet or their children's prospects for the future or whatever, but they certainly envy me for the work that my colleagues at IFAW and I get to do. And it's as I mentioned earlier, it is the privilege of my professional life, and And part of the attractiveness of this work, and I know in your own professional migration, you know, that's I'm sure that's a big part of the pull and power of it for you as
it's
well.
Huge.
Lucky us.
Yes, it's huge. It's amazing. And the time is now. So, yeah, I appreciate your taking the time to share all your knowledge with everybody. And yeah, hopefully we'll get the word out. And I think the key is just educating people that this is happening, because you can't help if you don't know.
Yeah, I mean, awareness before action, both of more are needed. And thank you so much for helping us at IFAW and others get the word out. Jenny, thanks so much. Great to meet you.
It was great to meet you too, Patrick. Thanks again for taking the time.
All right. Take care.
All right. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Hello Animal Talks, hosted by me, Jenny Worthington, production by Stacy Spencer of Going Graphic, sound engineered by Jimmy Richards of Bay Central Media, and music written and performed by Jake Shepard.